A few years ago, there was an article in Newsweek magazine that proclaimed, "We are all Hindus now. We are all Hindus now. And look, there we are." These are our middle schoolers. They're at the Richmond Hindu temple. And so I guess we are all Hindus now. Well, no, not literally. That Newsweek article was hardly a serious analysis, but what it did try to point out was that things are changing in the spiritual landscape in this country. And so this gives us an interesting opportunity now to first learn a little bit more about Hinduism, a little bit, to consider what is happening in the spiritual landscape in this country, and also to look with fresh eyes at our own faith of Unitarian Universalism. So, we are becoming more Hindu-like. What does that mean? Does it mean we're doing more yoga and saying namaste to each other? Is that what that means? And what does Hinduism mean anyway? Does anybody really know what Hinduism is? I mean, Hinduism is the world's, okay, maybe one of the world's oldest religions, right? It dates back to the Vedic religion in the Iron Age. That's like 3,000 years ago. And Hinduism is one of the largest religions. It has 1 billion adherents. And so that puts it in the top three. What's number one? Christianity. And then number two is Islam. And number three, Hinduism. But you know, to say that Hinduism is a religion just starts us off on shaky footing in the first place. It's not religion as our Western minds conceive of it. And when we say Hinduism is a religion like other religions, then really we miss the complex, multifacetedness of Hinduism. So first, the word Hindu itself describes people. It was a name given by outsiders to a group of people that they found living near the Indus River. So they became Hindus. It's not a word that describes a prophet like Christ, Christians, or Buddha, Buddhism. And it's not a word that describes a spiritual discipline or spiritual value like Islam, which means surrender, right? Secondly, Hinduism has no primary text. And so it is not a religion of the book. You know, it doesn't have the Bible, the Quran. It doesn't have the Torah. But it has a whole bunch of books, the Vedic texts, the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, lots and lots of different sacred texts. And then third, Hinduism has no spiritual founder. There was no one founder of the religion. There was no creation story about how it got started. And so in these ways, it's not religion per se. Hinduism describes a very broad conglomeration of philosophies and thoughts and traditions that span thousands and thousands of years. Now, some of those philosophies are seeping into our popular culture. And we find many, many more people embracing Hindu-like ideas. And the first of these ideas came from the Rig Veda. The Rig Veda was around back in 1500 BCE. In the Rig Veda, we find this saying, "Truth is one, but the sages speak of it by many names." In other words, there are many paths. There are many teachers, there are many ways to the truth. Now I know that actually it seems like these days people are growing more intolerant, actually, or less tolerant of differences. And that's because conflict makes for good news, not harmony, right? We hear about conflict between differing religions and different groups, because that's what makes good news. For example, I heard this story coming out of Spokane, Washington, about an Indian man named Paul, and ever since he was 8 years old, he played the sitar. Well, when he found a local church, he was so excited to find out that they had an orchestra. And so he dragged his sitar to the orchestra, and he started playing great old hymns like Amazing Grace and How Great Thou Art. And after a few weeks, their music director pulled him aside, and he said, "I'm sorry, but you've got to go." Apparently, the music director had been fielding calls for days from angry congregants who said that the instrument's sound made them uneasy. Some described it as devilish, and others said it was snaky. Now, Paul, on the other hand, thought it added a really beautiful cosmopolitan feel to those old hymns. So we hear stories about conflict like this, but really, in reality, Americans are becoming more tolerant. They are. As a whole, Americans are embracing this many paths to one truth idea. They say that 65% of us now believe that there is more than one true religion, more than one way toward salvation. And that's good news. That's really good news. Another Hindu-like quality or value that's rising in popularity is the question of the afterlife. A quarter of Americans say that they now believe in reincarnation. And I'm curious, do more UUs believe in reincarnation than the general public? So who here believes in reincarnation? So it's still about a quarter. You're not quite sure. I'm not sure. But you know, there are an awful lot of people who report having past lives. So I don't know what to do with those stories. The third way in which Americans are growing to be more Hindu-like is the way that we approach spirituality in general. And one spiritual writer calls it the divine deli cafeteria. Divine deli cafeteria, where you kind of pick and choose from different faiths to make something that works for you. And so, you know, on Saturday you'll go to Catholic Mass, and then on Monday you'll go to yoga and chant Om, and then on Wednesday you go to the Buddhist meditation group, and maybe on Friday you join your friend and go to the synagogue for Shabbat services. Divine deli cafeteria style. But is all that cafeteria food really good for us? I wonder. Or is it like Swami Vivekananda said, that we are just feeding our idle curiosity with the continuous succession of different ideals? Are we hungry for new, exciting ideas, but then ready to find something else as soon as that excitement wears off? In that quote, the Swami referred to religious liberalism, and I think he was talking to us. He spent a lot of time with Unitarians and Universalists in his time in the United States. And UUs, as a lot of you know, are particularly drawn to that divine deli cafeteria. It's part of our inherited religious culture. And this is a culture that prizes intellectual, rational practices over devotional practices. It's a culture where interesting ideas prevail over embodied ritual. When the Swami first started speaking in the United States, his messages were very pleasant. They were about harmony and being nice to each other, compassion, kindness. But gradually, he started talking about the rift between rationalism and spirituality that he thought marked the religions of the day. And he warned that if this rift was not soon healed, it would create this permanent wound. several of our most well-known Unitarian ancestors studied Hinduism quite seriously. Joseph Priestley, John Adams, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and all of his transcendentalist cohorts, including Thoreau, they dug deep into the Bhagavad Gita and many other Vedic texts. This was also the time when the universalists were moving to a different idea of universalism, not universal salvation so much as universal religion, many paths to one truth. And one wonders if the Hindus and Hinduism had not affected the universalists as well. So they dug deep, and they looked very deeply at the four paths to the divine. So the word yoga doesn't mean just downward facing dog and sun salutations. It's not just physical exercise, but the word yoga means path. And in Hinduism, there are four paths to the divine, four paths to the truth. So there's gyan, which is knowledge, raja, meditation, karma, action, and bhakti, devotion. Our Unitarian ancestors were very excited about gyan, of course, because it's about knowledge, although they really mean self-knowledge. They were excited about raja, about deep meditation practices, and they were really excited about action, especially social action. But they totally ignored bhakti. They were not interested in bhakti. They tended to view the lofty ideals as the inspired aspects of a religion and tended to view the devotional practices as the debased and superstitious part of a religion. And so they really weren't interested in that. And Swami Vivekananda spoke to the superstitious aspect when he said, yes, it's true that one of the great advantages of bhakti is that it is the easiest and most natural way to reach the great divine. But its great disadvantage is that in its lower forms, bhakti oftentimes degenerates into fanaticism. The fanatical crew in Hinduism and in Mohammedanism and Christianity have always exclusively recruited from these worshipers. That single attachment to a loved object without which no genuine love can grow is very often also the cause of the denunciation of everything else. Fanatics have only one way of loving their own ideals, and that is by hating the ideals of others. Herein is the explanation, he continues, of why the same man who is so lovingly attached to his own ideal of God, so devoted to his own ideal of religion, becomes a howling fanatic as soon as he sees or hears anything of another ideal. Because we have witnessed this in our lives, because we have experienced this kind of fanaticism, and because Unitarian Universalists have inherited that culture where we emphasize the intellectual and the ethical dimensions of a religion, we have tended to downplay the ritual, communal, visceral aspects of religion. Although I think we're changing, don't you? Do you? I think we are moving in a more visceral direction. This mindset colors the way we do interfaith, interreligious work. We want to talk to others about their philosophies. We want to read their books. We'd rather do that than engage in worship with them. We'd rather do that than join them in practices of devotion and adoration, rather than practices of ecstatic ritual, where one can lose oneself in rhythm and vibrations and the mysterious sound of Om and the smell of burning incense. Now, I am not going to suggest that we appropriate any of these practices into our own community. It wouldn't be right. What I am asking is for us all together to consider, what are the visceral dimensions of our faith? What are the visceral embodied dimensions of our faith? What are our rituals of devotion, adoration? When do we lose ourselves in music and in rhythm and in vibration, in chant, in prayer? You know, every community out there who is trying to do interfaith, interreligious work has a specific job to do. So there are communities out there who really need to let go of their idea that there is only one way, that there's one way. That's their work. And then there are communities out there that really need to let go of fear of the other. Did you hear about those people out in California who are freaked out that their children are doing yoga in school? So that's their work. We don't have to do that kind of work. We have a different kind of work to do. And our work has to do with bhakti. What is bhakti to Unitarian Universalist congregation? Well, I'm going to suggest one thing that we can do. The Hampton Roads Hindu Temple in Chesapeake is having a Diwali festival on November the 10th, 9th, it's Friday. It's the day right before our auction. So it's Friday, November the 9th in the evening. And it's not about going there to learn anything or to read any of their material. It's going there to join them in celebration, in dancing, in eating, and just feasting. So I'm going to go. If you all would like to join me, I think that would be a lot of fun. And in this way, let us do our interreligious work. In this real engagement, let us have true kinship of faith. May it be so.